It's a city packed with top-notch museums and a turbulent history. Berlin has become a center for 21st century commerce, as well as a funky place for artists and young creatives to call home.
I knew Berlin is my city when I was 17, 18 years of age, and I knew that is the city I want to go in.
Coming up, guides from Berlin update us on what's new in their city, where an extension to their subway line makes it even easier to navigate on foot.
I've lived there for 19 years. Not once have I ever thought about getting a car because you just don't need it.
We'll also hear how joining the Peace Corps helped one young American to appreciate the advantages he grew up with. Working and living in another culture halfway around the world can really develop your character.
For me, it was this experience that really tested who I was as a person and who I wanted to become as a person.
Reflections on serving in the Peace Corps and what's new in Berlin. It's all in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. It's a sprawling city of 3.5 million. Berlin offers leafy boulevards with neoclassical buildings and monuments that remind you of its dense history. And it has lively and mostly affordable neighborhoods for young creatives and immigrants to call home. In just a minute, two guides from Berlin update us on what's new in their city. And a former Peace Corps volunteer reflects on the value of a stint in the U.S. Foreign Service venture that President Kennedy established back in 1961. Nothing captures the epitome of modern Europe, to me, quite like Berlin. It's lively, complicated, and it's captivating. Continuously evolving while confronting its past. Berlin today is a hub for creativity and culture, and it's simply an enjoyable place to hang out. Now, balancing its rich traditions and its diverse population, Berlin is where that fine line between history and current events is kind of excitingly blurry. Right now, I'd like to find out how things are faring in Germany's dynamic first city with two Berlin-based tour guides, Holger Zimmer and Jim McDonough. Holger and Jim, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
What an energy in Berlin. I was just there with both of you guys.
Yeah.
And it was just a thrill for me to get up to date with it. And it's great that we can do that now on our radio show. And Holger, first of all, tell me, how is Berlin part of your life?
Oh, it's been a long time. I call myself a Berliner now, even though, you know, I've only lived there only like 35 years, roughly. So I came there just after the wall had come down.
Were actually attracted to Berlin when the wall came down?
Oh, I was attracted to Berlin way before. I was a little high school kid, and I hitchhiked across Eastern Germany, through Eastern Germany, to go to West Berlin to party there with my friends. And it was like, I knew Berlin is my city when I was 17, 18 years of age, and I knew that is the city I want to go in. And whenever the wall came down, as soon as that came down,
so
I was
there. So we have
to
remember that before 1989, right?
Yeah.
That you would have been in West Germany,
Berlin
was mostly West German, but it was an island of the West in the middle of the East.
So West Berlin was,
West
indeed,
Berlin,
yes.
Yeah. And you've stayed there ever since?
I stayed there ever since. It's my home now. Absolutely. I love it.
And I feel a great love for Berlin when I'm with you in your adopted home city. Now, Jim, you're an American. How did you end up in Berlin, and what's your story?
Well, I went to Berlin years ago as a college student, and I received an academic scholarship to study for a year in Berlin to study German history. And I ended up just staying after I was done and became a tour guide. And that's what I've been doing now for the last 17 years.
Now, I noticed there's a lot of Americans that ended up in Berlin. And a lot of you have a fascination with history, it seems like.
Absolutely. I mean, Berlin is one big outdoor museum. And not only does it have its history, but it's also got its cultural opportunities. It's got its wonderful recreational activities that you can do in the summertime. Seems like it's got something for everybody.
Now, it's a fascinating story for me because I was writing a guidebook that covered Berlin before 1990 and after 1990. And Berlin was well divided before the end of communism there.
Right.
And you had all the museums had been in the center, but now they had been, it's like a biological thing where a cell splits, you know, and the museums went to the east and the west, get into your corner, get into your corner. And then suddenly Berlin has to knit itself back together. So what was the center of the city, Potsdamer Platz, became no man's land.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the wall, and everybody turns their back to the wall was the least desirable real estate, because who wants to be up against a wall,
yeah,
especially a wall like that? And suddenly the wall's gone, and Potsdamer Platz becomes the center again, the Times Square of Berlin. But it's a fascinating story how the museums went back to the center, and that they used to joke that the crane was the city bird, and there's always cranes there.
But coming back to this idea of museums moving, and when we had the division, You know, both sides, West Berlin as much as East Berlin, wanted to shine, wanted to show off, like, we're the center of communism in East Germany. We're great. We can do this. And we built these wonderful TV towers, which actually the Swedish had built because the East Germans couldn't do it. On the West also, it's a beacon of capitalism. So the cool thing about Berlin is you have most things double or triple. We have three opera houses. Imagine that. Like, one city in Germany has three opera houses because of that division, because everyone wanted to have their own thing. And now we're together.
And I think communist Europe was a very, very good at making a false sense of prosperity and success as a showcase, right? So you had that television tower. You had the, Jim, what was the boulevard, the Russian Gothic boulevard in Berlin?
The Karl Marx Allee, which was originally called the Stalin Allee, changed to Karl Marx Allee. Right. It was a big showcase.
Stalin Allee.
Mm-hmm.
Was that subsidized by Russia to show off?
I mean, Russia was playing a big part because the architects went to Russia to see, oh, what was the empire style? You know, how do we do it? And then it was basically, it was like rebuilt the city because everything was completely devastated.
1945, and the city was just flat.
Was leveled. And so in this area, they wanted to have the showcase, like palaces for the working people.
Showcase blasts. Yeah. And even today, there's a lot of people living there. And I understand it's actually kind of trendy now to live there. And it's comfortable. You got this old, kind of elegant, but in a Stalinistic kind of way, mass housing on this Grand Boulevard.
I would say, I think it's beautiful. If you ever want to know what Moscow looks like without going to Moscow, come to East Berlin.
I remember going to a cafe out there, a cafe.
Sibylle.
And it was famous because it had Stalin's mustache.
His ear, actually.
Oh, his ear. Yeah, that was it.
Right,
Stalin's
exactly.
ear. From what was that? What was the big deal? Was that part of a statue or something?
Yes, it was. It was part of a statue, and they put it there on display as something that people could just come in and look at.
Because it was the largest Stalin statue outside of Russia, and then when they pulled it down, like overnight, when Stalin fell out of favor, just some things survived, and this era is still there to be seen.
And it's a reminder that when you're that evil, when you fall out of favor, very little of what you did survives because you don't see anything about Stalin anywhere except his ear at this cafe, which is kind of just a historical joke. The point is, Berlin has been a work in progress because of its difficult history and so on. And when we visit today, there's still a lot going on. Our guides to Berlin on Travel with Rick Steves are both longtime residents of the German capital. American Jim McDonnell has made it his home ever since studying abroad. And Holger Zimmer moved to Berlin shortly after the wall came down. He was part of an influx of young artists and musicians who brought their creative energy to the city. Holger also covers art, film, music, and culture for local media in Berlin. Now, when I think about downtown central rebuilding, trying to revitalize Berlin, I think of Potsdamer Platz because I've got sort of a romantic view of Potsdamer Platz. It's, as I say, it's the Times Square, I think, of Berlin. And at one time, it was arguably the most thriving and busy square in Europe.
Yeah, first traffic light was there.
First traffic light. And you can still see a monument to that.
Replica of it.
And today, you go there, and you've got bits of the Berlin Wall stacked there, like capitalism dancing on the grave of communism. And those slices of the Berlin Wall, caked in graffiti, are now covered in chewing gum. What do you think about when you go to the Potsdamer Platz and you see that, Jim?
Well, it's a testament to the fact that Berlin is just an evolving city. It's just got all this modernity around it. And now you take something like the Berlin Wall that divided that city for 28 years, and now you're able to just go up and put your gum on it, I think is saying that we've come a long way since the fall of it.
Now, that used to be Big Hope. That was the Sony Center and all this. I remember it was big news in Berlin. It feels kind of like anticlimactic when you get there now.
It is. It's a place for tourists to come to. The whole idea was to bring back that prestige. You know, you had the best entertainment venues on Potsdamer Platz. You had the world-class hotels before World War II. But then, of course, it all lay in ruin in 1945. And then half of it ends up in the British sector, the other Soviet sector, and then a wall is built across it. I mean, imagine going to New York City today, and I say this to my tourists, is that go to New York City today, tear down all the buildings on Times Square and build
a wall through it.
And it's just inconceivable. But that's exactly what happened in Berlin.
Yeah.
And so the idea was to bring all that back. There was the hope that all those big businesses that left Berlin would come back after the reunification. But they didn't.
It didn't work.
It didn't work out.
So now the tourists go there, and like I do, you stand and you straddle the little brass monument in the pavement that says this was the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
And you're 1 foot's in the east and 1 foot's in the west. Holger.
Like, but I mean, this whole area, it's kind of mixed. So as it doesn't quite work as a shopping area so much.
Doesn't.
But when Berlin was divided, they put the Berlin Philharmonic there. And that is still like there, because now Berlin is unified and it's right in the center and not in the outskirts anymore like it was when they built it. So, and next door is the Kulturforum, amazing Gemäldegalerie, like the old masters. There's a museum for art and design, arts and crafts.
So I think the best painting gallery in Germany, you
could
say.
It's quite amazing. So there is arts and culture there as well. So do make a point going there, but know where to go.
You and I were just going down Unter den Linden, and that's the Grand Boulevard, I think, of Berlin now, leading up to the Pariserplatz and Brandenburg Gate. And we got to the Humboldt Forum, the old Hohenzollern Palace. And I have fond memories of that during communism as a very kind of a bleak people's palace. What was it called during?
Yeah, Palast der Republik, or they call it Honecker's Lampenladen. That was like the nickname because it was full of like lamps and glitzer. But of course, it was like just a...
So what was Honecker?
He's the head honcho of East Germany, right?
And so in English, it was
Like Honecker's lamp shop, if you wish, because it was really like, it was a glitzy
place. It was like a lamp shop. Yeah, if you go into a lamp shop here, you got lamps hanging from the ceiling.
Huge facade with glass and you know, glittering lamps. And it was built, a showcase.
It was built on the very important historic spot.
Absolutely, because what was there before was a Baroque palace for the Hohenzollern dynasty, who ruled not only Berlin, but Prussia. And Germany.
And that was the palace. Of course, World War II was destroyed. Communists come in, they build a glitzy, on their standards, people's palace there. And then they tore that down because it had
asbestos
in it. So you got a grassy field, which I kind of liked. And then there's a big discussion in Berlin of what are we going to do?
Big discussion.
So Holger, they finally did it. And it's up, it's open. And what do you think of it? Tell us what it is, the Humboldt Forum.
It's a strange beast, to be honest. You know, as I said, you have now suddenly in the middle of Berlin, like a replica of a Prussian palace, you know, together with all the details, the sandstone, the angels, the facades and everything.
Yeah.
But it's partly is modern. Franco Stella was the architect. So it's part modern, part old looking.
Yeah.
And it is this threesome. It has like part museum, part exhibition space, part library.
Lot of work for you and me when I was working on it for the new edition in my guidebook, because there's a lot of dimensions to that. And Berlin is really invested in it. And it is quite an impressive place for culture, for history, for local pride. And architecturally, what a statement. Because on one side, you've got the Hohenzollern Palace facade. And then the other, you've got this brutalism. And it's right there on the island where all the museums are and the great cathedral. And that's really, in so many ways, the center of Berlin.
And it does talk about, you can visit the basements like we did. You go down and you see like the foundations, the fundaments, because there's not much of Middle Ages left in Berlin because of destruction. So that's a part you can see. But then you have the first or second floor. There's a huge like permanent exhibition called Berlin Global, which really talks about how Berlin interacts with the world, also addressing colonial history, something that we're just kind of discovering in Germany. And that's, I think it's a very telling exhibition.
Holger Zimmer and Jim McDonnell are our guides in What's New in Berlin right now on Travel with Rick Steves. We'll continue in a moment with a look at renovation projects that keep the city on the move and some of the new attractions you might look out for. And later, a former Peace Corps volunteer tells us about the life lessons he gained from a 2-year assignment to a former Soviet Republic of Central Asia. Danke schön for being with us today on Travel with Rick Steves. The German capital city of Berlin is our destination today on Travel with Rick Steves. Berlin-based tour guides Holger Zimmer and Jim McDonnell are our guests today as they update us on what's new in the city that is somehow both timeless and always changing. For anybody dreaming of going to Berlin, the Reichstag, you know, the wonderful new parliament building with the glass dome on the top, what is going on there? The German History Museum, which I think is so good, it's closed. I'm wondering what's happening there. And the Pergamum Museum. Everybody wants to go to the antiquities at the Pergamum Museum. Jim, what's the latest with the Reichstag, just quite quickly?
Well, what they're doing is building a new visitor center. And this will give visitors a chance then to access the Reichstag underground, kind of like the U.S. Capitol. Because right now they've got these ugly white containers in front of the parliament. They want to get rid of that. There's also security issues. Because it's free to visit the parliament, to go up to the top of the dome, to have a bird's eye view of the city. So this is the project.
If you have a reservation.
If you have a reservation, right. And it's a 250 million euro project, and it should be done by 2030.
Boy, that's going to be really something for Berlin to be proud of. I think we have the same vision for something like that at our Capitol building. And it's just so great that Berlin is doing that. And Holger, what's the latest with the German History Museum?
Yeah, I think they're closed for renovation at the moment. Yeah. And I think the latest word is that probably when this show airs, that might be up and running again.
Up and running. Ah, that's good.
So, but hey, I've lived in Berlin for 35 years, and I know whenever they tell me like a year when things are finished, yeah. I'll take it with a big pinch of salt, to be honest.
Okay, but they're talking about the Pergamon Museum. That's going to be at least a decade before it's open. Why do people think the Pergamon Museum is so important to visit? What's there? And is there a way to see that while the main museum is closed?
Yeah, the thing is, it really is closed now. It will be for quite a long time. What's it, 2037 or something, they say. But hey, yeah, the Pergamon Altar is a huge piece of architecture from like the ancient times to really get an idea of what a temple district would have looked like. You know, that is quite something. So they renovate this, but what they've done now to kind of compensate for this loss as it's being renovated, they put like a panorama building where you can see this temple district kind of almost come alive.
Is it like a photorealistic painting?
That's indeed what it is.
It's like what we went to at Checkpoint Charlie.
Yep.
And there's one at Wittenberg about Reformation. So this is by a guy named Assisi?
Yeah, Jadega Assisi is a great, wonderful visionary with shadow and with light and with sound. And we're really part of this, you know, scene from ancient cultures to see people doing sacrifice to the gods.
Well, it's a time tunnel experience with the help of photorealistic painting. I was just walking down Unter den Linden, and we get to Friedrichstrasse. And I remember during the rebuilding process, the great hope for Friedrichstrasse. Holger, what was the vision for Friedrichstrasse and what was how it panned out for that investment?
I think the idea was to, you know, as many cities do that in Europe these days, try to get less cars and more bikes and more pedestrians in. The only thing is, though, it didn't quite work out when they closed it because it is like a very important through road, north-south. It's a long street. So it didn't quite work. So now they opened it up for like car traffic and... It was an attempt that failed, I would say, but it's part of this.
It just wasn't as vital. Jim, I remember that when capitalism was coming back, they were going to use Friedrichstrasse as kind of a Fifth Avenue. And of course, you'd have the greatest European department store there, the Galerie Lafayette, right?
Exactly.
And that was a destination just to see the architecture inside. You and I just walked into that a couple months ago. What happened to the Galerie Lafayette? Because it just closed.
Right. Well, the plan to bring back the Friedrichstrasse to its pre-war status, and you have to remember that this was a glittering surface of Berlin. America had its roaring 20s. Well, so did Berlin had its roaring 20s.
Right.
And all of that was destroyed during the war. It fell in the Soviet sector under communist East Germany, and the East German government just ignored it because it was at the edge of town.
Yeah.
Checkpoint Charlie was at the bottom of the street.
Oh, that's
West
right.
Berlin.
It was a dead end up against Checkpoint Charlie.
Exactly. And so the East German government, they concentrate all their post-war building around the Alexanderplatz and then down Stalin Allee that became Karl Marx Allee.
Turning their back on the West.
Exactly. And so all of a sudden, you've just got this dead zone here. And then the idea then, especially after 1991, when it's decided that Berlin is going to be the capital of the reunified Germany once again, we need to rejuvenate. We need to bring back the Friedrichstrasse. So lots of money was pumped into that street. The Galerie Lafayette as well was the idea to get people, get that hustle and bustle going again.
But long story short, it failed.
It failed.
And the department store went out of business. And what are they going to do with that big building?
Well, they're not going to turn it into a state library.
Well, a state library. Yeah. There you go. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about what's new in Berlin. And we're joined by Holger Zimmer and Jim McDonough. Berlin is a vast city, a sprawling city, but once you grapple with and get comfortable with the underground, the subway, you're empowered, aren't you? And I understand, Jim, there's a new subway line that's opening up that'll be great for travelers.
Yeah, it's actually already completed, and it was finished during COVID. It's a new stretch of the U5 line, which runs basically from the Central Station Hauptbahnhof to Alexanderplatz. It's a one-mile stretch, a 265 million euro project, but it now allows visitors to basically just zip down Unter den Linden. And when I take my guests around Berlin, it's become so convenient because it's basically just a belt that goes right through the heart of the city. And, you know, that's one thing about Berlin is that it has a fantastic public transportation network. I've lived there for 19 years. Not once have I ever thought about getting a car because you just don't need it. You can get within every square inch of the city in a very timely fashion. And they still have more plans to really expand the subway line as well. So this embracing of public transport is something that I think is just something we can really take advantage of and be grateful for as Berliners.
Embracing. That's the key word for a tourist, for a traveler visiting. And I'm always a good example. When I get there, I don't have the bandwidth. I'm tired. I just take a taxi to my hotel.
And I realized it would have been faster and cheaper and just smarter to get down in the S-Bahn or the U-Bahn and get the day pass or whatever.
Certainly.
And after a couple of days in Berlin, I realized, yeah, baby, I know the tram that serves my hotel. I know where the U-Bahn connection is. I can get anywhere in a snap, and I'm a temporary local. Holger, I know in Germany, you can have the whole country to be your oyster with the public transit. And there's even a subsidized monthly pass.
That's true. The no Deutschland ticket, which is basically like $50, something like this.
$50. Yeah. $50 a month.
Yeah, a month. And you can basically use every kind of public transport anywhere in Germany, with the exception maybe of the high speed, like intercity trains, but yeah, all the regional trains and buses. What a great thing. I have it. And whenever I'm like in Cologne, in Hamburg, I don't have to think about buying a ticket, where to get it, what to do. Is it still valid? No, I have this one ticket and I can ride any. And I think that is a wonderful thing.
That
and it's part of this idea of make public transport available, make it accessible, and get people to use it instead of using the car, blocking the roads and the streets.
It's a green thing to fight climate change. And you cannot overestimate the efficiency of the German train system. I mean, I was just in Hamburg and it's hourly departures, 2 hours, and bam, you're in Berlin. And if you got that monthly pass as a resident, you can just do it without a second thought. Hey, you guys, when we think about Berlin, I think about Gendarmenmarkt. It's an elegant bit of Paris in the middle of Berlin, but last time I was there, it was a mess. Berlin's loveliest square was a construction zone. What's happening, Holger?
Well, it's all been dug up, and it's kind of a modern project, and the catchphrase they use is Schwammstadt, like sponge city. So the idea, which is a great idea, actually, to see how we can manage wastewater, how we can manage the canalization system to have actually the city cleaner. And maybe one day, if they've been working this for 15 years now, one day that we can actually swim in Berlin's river Spree again.
Really?
That would be a lovely plan. So the idea is to completely remodel it, but install something so the rain will actually be kept and then kind of processed more gently. The only kind of downturn of the thing is, what is it, Jim? 20 million? Is
20 that million euros.
For one square. And it took like years. And all the tourists were like, what are we doing? We can't look at it. But it will be finished soon.
So it's something to keep on our radar, but a couple years down. You know, it's so funny to hear you say that, oh, we're going to make the Spree so you can, we're going to spend the money and invest in it so it's clean enough to be swimming in. You know, Paris did that at the Olympics, and they spent a lot of money doing it.
Oh, they did.
But I guess you could give them a ring and see if it was money well spent.
Mm-hmm. We wonder.
we do.
Also, I wondered when you were talking about it so enthusiastically about the Sponge City or whatever. I was in Kreuzberg, where they're re-envisioning the neighborhoods, and these streets were being re-divvied up so that bicycles and pedestrians would be very comfortable. And there was planter boxes and there was little playgrounds in the middle of the streets, in the middle of a neighborhood. And then you have these very Germanic, very efficient information panels that have a printout and different charts and everything. And my friend, my local guide said, in Berlin, we love our digital information posts. Do you know what I mean about that? Germany just gets into this. I mean, what do you find about that?
Yeah, they sure do. I mean, it's that sort of transparency, I would have to say, since the reunification, to bring information, public information, to let us know what used to go on in these different places. And Holger and I were talking about this before. I mean, Berlin is a big city. It's got its own little downtown areas. It's got it's a collection of small villages historically. And so I think these districts, they take a lot of pride in being able to give information to the public.
Transparency. Germany has learned from this, and I feel like there's a spirit in Germany now to be very forthcoming and transparent, and people want to know what's the story. That's kind of the symbol of the glass dome on top of the Reichstag, the parliament building, so people can figuratively at least look down through the glass ceiling over the shoulders of their legislators and see what's on their desks. Our Travel with Rick Steves overview of what's new in Berlin is with American-born Jim McDonald. Jim has made his home in Berlin now for more than 17 years. And Holger Zimmer, who was raised near the former border between West and East Germany. Holger made his way to the big city as part of German reunification not long after the wall came down back in 1989. They're two of the local guides that I depend on for updating my guidebooks and information on the German capital. One great thing about Berlin is the neighborhoods. And as a visitor, we need to know what neighborhood to check out and then celebrate it. Do Unterdenland and do the great museums, but get out into the neighborhoods. Jim, tell me, when we think of Prince Lauenberg, that was a place that, well, it's changed a lot in the last generation.
Right. Prince Lauenberg has really, you know, historically, that was a very working class part of Berlin. And then it fell in East Berlin and also had not as much war damage compared to some of the other neighborhoods. So you have all these beautiful pre-war buildings. And then once the wall falls, then all of a sudden people who live in apartments that belong to a state that doesn't exist, they leave. You have then young people that come in and start squatting. And Holger's one of them who basically goes in and starts to bring a lot of vibrancy to this part of town. And now it's become such, over the years, it's transformed into a very trendy area that we're seeing a lot of gentrification going on.
So this is a fascinating story. And what I love about having a local guide, and I just got to mention to all of our travelers and listeners, can you imagine what a joy it is for me to walk through the streets of a city like Berlin with Jim or Holger and say, tell me about the squatters in Prince Lauenburg. And then Holger would say, well, I was a squatter. Holger, yeah, tell us about that.
Actually, so think about it, 1990, the wall had just come down and a lot of the flats were empty, and then people would just kind of, you know, look around to see if there's no light in it. So maybe next day we come and kick the door in and see, okay, there's an empty flat. And there was young people like me being 19, 20 years of age. And back in the day in East Germany, you could not just rent a flat. You had to go to a special state office and ask and apply, maybe can I please rent someplace? And they said, well, no, don't apply. You don't have a family. So anyway, it was difficult for young people to find a place. And then suddenly, boom, the state is gone. There is no more East Germany. And then people just kind of find a place to live, take it up like we did, and we renovated it. And then a year later, we went to the office and said, hey, actually, by the way, we're living there and we renovated it. So why don't you give us like a contract? And they said, okay, pay 30 marks a month and there you go. And that's how it works.
Did eventually those squatters, some of them get to buy that, or did they just homestead?
Yeah, I wouldn't say buy, but a lot of them, like these contracts were legalized. And of course, then in the course of time, quite often, these buildings were then later bought by maybe the former owners from West Germany or some other corporations.
And then they got kicked out?
Sometimes they would kicked out, or they would have to find, like, the corporation would have to find for them a different flat. So it is, but it's true what Jim is saying. The old, let's say, working class neighborhood, the district where a lot of working class people worked, is completely transformed. There's a lot of new people coming in, young people.
It's so gentrified now. It's just like, it's almost like you can't believe this used to be hippies and bohemians and a bunch of squatters and punks.
You can't afford it anymore.
And now you've got people with their strollers and their lattes and this kind of thing. But there's still a couple of little enclaves of that squatter, bohemian chic stuff. But Prince Lauenberg, that's where I like to stay when I'm in Berlin, and some of it is really funky and others is just very charming. The last thing I'd like to talk about is Kreuzberg, because Kreuzberg is known as the Turkish quarter. I think some people say the second biggest Turkish city in the world is Berlin or something.
That's true.
Like that.
That's right.
And Kreuzberg was the least desirable real estate during the Cold War because it was stuck up against the wall and nobody wanted to live against the wall. It was going to last forever. Suddenly the wall's gone. Kreuzberg is in the middle of the city, and it's more desirable land, but it has still got that funky, multicultural personality. What do you feel like when you walk through Kreuzberg, Jim?
Well, it's very energetic, and you think about the history of Kreuzberg, and that was an area where so many guest workers after World War II had settled, primarily from Turkey, and they stayed there, and they brought their own culture, they brought their own cuisine, and now you have some of the finest Turkish restaurants in the city, and they have their Turkish market, and it's a testament to Berlin's status as a huge international city, a melting pot where all cultures come together. They offer something for the city, and that's why we say Berlin is just a whole different animal. It's got this amazing feel due to its international appeal.
Holger, you've lived your adult life in Berlin. You've seen so much change. I'm fascinated by how different cultures deal with immigrant communities. And, of course, the first Gastarbeiters, the origin of the term guest worker, which is almost multilingual now or whatever, those were the Turks coming to Germany to get work so they could send money back to their loved ones.
Yeah, from Turkey, from Portugal, from Italy. Like, basically, Germany went out to different countries and said, listen,
we need the workers.
We need workers to work in our car manufacturer or whatever.
If we were honest in the United States, we'd all know we need the workers from south of the border.
Yeah.
Now, but I was going to ask you, I feel like Berlin has done quite well with the reality of giving dignity to an immigrant community. As a Berliner, when you look at that, how's it gone?
Well, I think there's kind of two sides to the coin here, because one is like coming and working and settling and being here. The other thing is like, what is the story with language, with integration, with like coming to be part of the culture that you're settling in?
Yeah.
And I think, let's face it, there are some areas in Berlin where you can, you know, have people just basically talking Turkish, which is not a bad thing. But some of the, let's say, second or third generation even are having a hard time, you know, struggling with language, struggling with education. And that's something that is, I think it's a two-way thing. You know, it's what the Germany can do to accommodate, but it's also what people who come to Germany can do to be part of the open society.
Is assimilate an okay word?
I wouldn't say assimilate. It's more like respect where you are. That's what I would say.
That's the challenge. And Berlin, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to watch. And you see a lot of that reality in Kreuzberg. And you walk through the neighborhoods of Kreuzberg. I was just down the Admiral Brücke, the Admiral's Bridge, at sunset.
That's where everyone gathers to have a little
babies.
Drink and, you know, street music.
The canal
music.
Was under street music. The local convenience store is geared up to just sell thousands of bottles of beer. There's the pizza place and the ice cream place. And then you just go, you buy your $2 beer, and you get yourself a slice of pizza, and you sit down on Admiral's Bridge. It's just some kind of amazing community scene.
Yeah, it's a vibe. Yeah. Well, a lot of international people also come. It's got this energy going. That's, you know, that's part of this open vibe of Berlin.
Everybody was there enjoying a beautiful evening, celebrating Berlin's ability to live together. And it is a work in progress, and it's a delight to visit. Holger Zimmer, Jim McDonough, Danke schön for a beautiful, beautiful visit to Berlin.
Thanks a lot, Rick.
Thanks for having us, Rick. And folks, do come to Berlin.
You'll find more about Berlin on our website at ricksteves.com/radio. Nearly 3 years before President John F. Kennedy would deliver his famous I Am a Berliner speech in Berlin, he issued a challenge to some 10,000 students at the University of Michigan. It was an impromptu campaign appearance late on an October night. Kennedy proposed creating a program that would send young, idealistic Americans like them to use their skills to help with developing nations overseas. With an executive order a few months later, Kennedy created the Peace Corps. Up next, a Peace Corps volunteer is back with us on Travel with Rick Steves to reflect on what the experience did for him. Ever since it was founded in April of 1961, the Peace Corps has grown as a volunteer-based branch of the U.S. Foreign Service. More than 200,000 volunteers have been sent to use their skills to help out people where they need it most. They're assigned to nearly 60 countries today. Their mission is to partner with participating countries and host communities to provide service and training where they need it. It helps promote a better understanding of Americans in those countries, and Peace Corps volunteers come back to the USA with a better understanding of those countries and their cultures. After graduating from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas with degrees in history and art, Tim Suchlin signed up for a 2-year stint with the Peace Corps. They sent him to Kazakhstan to teach English at a secondary school. Tim writes in his memoir that living in the town of Yavlenka was as surreal as a sitcom in a vast landscape on the steppes of Central Asia. Tim's book is called A Five-Finger Feast, 2 Years in Kazakhstan, Lessons from the Peace Corps. Tim, welcome back to Travel with Rick Steves.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So these three goals, that's pretty interesting. And one thing is, you're going to learn about them, and that means we're going to learn about them because you come home and you bring that sensibility.
Yep.
They're going to learn about us. You represent us in their country, mm-hmm. and to provide a service. Now, that service is interesting because that mixes in politics and culture, and a lot of times they don't want to know how we do it, or, mm-hmm. or they're offended by how we do it. How is that finessed?
So the first goal of the Peace Corps for Kazakhstan was they— in the early 90s, wanted to have English teachers. They wanted to improve English education. I think they saw that as a means to connecting with the outside world.
Because up until then, they had been Moscow ruled, and the mm-hmm. second language would have been Russian,
yes.
I'm sure.
Yeah, actually, probably the primary language would have been Russian, and the secondary language would have been maybe Kazakh or whatever ethnic language that the people were speaking. So the government wanted English education and to improve English education.
Oh, so they call up the Peace Corps and they say, hey, we're open now.
We're
free. We want to look a little more west. Send your guys over. We'll take the free teachers.
Yeah, we'll take the free work. Yeah. And so the Peace Corps went in 1993 and operated until 2011. Our primary job for most of the volunteers was English education, especially in rural areas where it's harder to get English teachers. Mm. So a majority of the volunteers were working in pretty remote rural villages.
Did they want you to also bring Western values?
I don't necessarily think they wanted Western values. They want to connect to the rest of the world. They see that as like an economic opportunity.
Economic thing, yeah. But nobody was looking over your shoulder saying you can't talk about that.
Well, there were certain things to be cautious about. The Peace Corps actually helped train us as well, just to be cautious about certain topics. And,
yeah.
And as well, there were sort of a contingent of people within the Kazakhstani government who didn't want Peace Corps there.
Right.
Sort of the old KGB people in the bureaucracy.
Do you think the Peace Corps has an agenda to be evangelical about American values up front, or is that just the hopeful result of exposing people to us?
I mean, I think if you look at the history of the Peace Corps, yeah, there's a little bit of evangelical
Americanism,
you know, why it was started during the Cold War. But I think overall, the intention of the Peace Corps is to promote world friendship and world exchange of ideas to promote openness in the world.
So that was a great thing from the optimistic times of John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
What's the status today? Is the Peace Corps still something America is enthusiastic about, or does that ebb and flow depending on who's president?
I would love for Americans to be enthusiastic about the Peace Corps. I think for me, I think it's actually one of the greatest things that America has ever done.
Well, I know you think
that,
but what about who's ruling our country?
Exactly. I think, probably there's some ebb and flow in who is in charge of the country as well. I mean, it's a government agency. But I think there's a lot of bipartisanship in the Peace Corps because there are both people who are on the left of the spectrum and the right of the spectrum, and they're, you know, that they have Peace Corps experiences.
Yeah.
Some of my best friends today are Peace Corps volunteers just because you form a community when you're in your country, your host country.
What do you guys understand that the rest of us don't? I mean, because you do have that bond. I think there's something special.
Well, it's probably a little bit like if you're in the military or any sort of tight-knit, you know, organization.
Yeah.
One of my friends and I, when I first moved to Seattle, he was here. And we actually were in the Peace Corps together but didn't know each other particularly well. And we connected here because of our Peace Corps experience.
Yeah.
He was living here. I moved here. And his dad was a former Navy officer, and he would just love to hear our stories. He said we had better stories than his Navy stories just because of the stuff that we had to experience.
You know, I just noticed while you're talking, on the spine of your book, it says Peace Corps Writers. That, mm-hmm. That's your publisher.
Yeah, that's a small organization that promotes essentially putting the stories out there for Peace Corps volunteers, returned volunteers.
I would imagine there's a little oversight on the tenor of your reporting.
Not a whole lot. I mean, they're independent of the Peace Corps. So,
okay. So it's a good read. It can be candid.
Yeah, exactly. So,
warts and all.
I was trying to be as candid in my book as I could be. And, you know, there are some downsides to the Peace Corps, but overall, I think it's a really positive organization.
We're hearing about the benefits of a 2-year volunteer stint with the Peace Corps from Tim Suchlin right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Tim describes his experiences in Kazakhstan in his book, A Five-Finger Feast. For an earlier interview with Tim, there's a link to our show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. Now, you wrote pretty frankly in your book about the loneliness, the mundane, you know, the difficulties of spending 2 years so far from home, and especially Kazakhstan. I mean, Kazakhstan's a big, arid, landlocked, sparsely populated, poor place.
Yeah, yeah.
With a lot of baggage.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah.
It's a complicated mess.
It is. It's a complicated country. Yeah, there was some times when it was lonely. There's boredom. You know, there's only so many elementary conversations in Russian that I could have with a local because my Russian was not very good.
And where was the nearest Peace Corps volunteer?
The nearest one was about 2 hours from me in a city called Petropolisk. So, and there was a small group of us in and around that city.
So you'd rarely get together and you'd have some interesting conversations.
Yeah, for sure. Getting together with the other volunteers was always a nice experience because we can just kind of let loose and be who we are. You know, we didn't have to be on guard because when you're a Peace Corps volunteer, you're kind of in a fishbowl. You are the American in your sight.
So you walk down the street and
everyone knew who I was.
There goes Tim. What did they call you?
Yeah, they would call me Timothy Mr. Suchland was the
Mr.
the name in school. And so you'd walk down the street and everyone knew who you were. I had many random people approach me and just be like, hey, you're the American. What are you doing here?
Well, I wonder about that. And I want to talk about that because I would think there'd be maybe some older people or more people that had a hang up against capitalism or the West or whatever.
Yeah.
And you represent a lot that's different from their heritage.
Yeah, of course.
So what was that experience like? How did you have to disarm that?
Well, I would say most people were curious. You know, they were like, they were more curious than who you are. They wanted to get to know who I was and also the mission of what the Peace Corps was doing. And some people were familiar with the Peace Corps and why we were there, mm-hmm. And saw the, you know, the benefits of that.
It must have confused other people.
Yeah. And then you'd get an older generation of people. And I'd say some of them were even more curious than the younger ones, because the younger ones already, you know, when I was there, you can listen to a Katy Perry song on the radio, or you could, you know, these different pop things that they would get.
Tim, you were there for 2 years, and in your book, there's sort of like the happy year and then the year that was kind of a drag.
Yeah.
the way I gathered, you were in a vibrant family for the first year, and then you were in the home of a lonely, quiet babushka for the second year with almost no reason to get excited about anything.
She was great, though. I mean, it was... She was a widow, and so she just wanted somebody to live with her, you know, just to keep her company and have a second person around. And that year, it was probably not as exciting because it's, you know, the first year, everything's fresh and new and different.
Yeah.
And the second year, I was getting used to everything, and my Russian was improving. And partly my Russian improved because she spoke no English. And so we just spoke Russian and have tea together and then watch Russian soap operas every evening. So
you watch Russian soap operas every evening with a babushka?
Yes, those were our evenings.
And I bet the plot of a Russian soap opera is predictable enough where you don't need a mastery of the language.
No, yeah.
Well, tell me about the first year, because that sounded like fun.
Yeah, so I think the first year I was with a Kazakh family in my village, and they had two parents in their late 30s and then three teenage siblings. And that year, there seemed to be a lot of kind of pomp and circumstance about my arrival. I was the judge in a local beauty contest. I was asked to come to different events in
the
village.
Wait a minute. They took the American who didn't know anything about the culture, really, to be a judge in the beauty contest.
Yes. Yeah.
And, Tell me about that.
Yeah. So the first few weeks that I arrived to my site, I get this invite to come and be a judge of the Miss Asil, that was the region I lived in, beauty contest. And it was a little awkward because some of those people in the contest were my students at my secondary school I worked at. So, but I spoke really no Russian at that point. And so I had one of my best English students as my interpreter to tell me what was going on.
And were there different parts of the contest? Were there the... talent and and the beauty and all that.
Yeah, there was like talent and fashion, and there was a bikini contest. It was really strange to be this judge, and all the other judges were esteemed people within the community, like business people and government officials.
You were esteemed then.
Yeah,
you made the cut.
I was the youngest, 22, you know, at the time, and youngest judge in that whole contest.
Did the winner then go to the nationals?
You know, I didn't really understand enough to know what was next, but the winner was essentially decided by the mayor of the village. So
okay.
He chose it, and that's where we went with.
Tim Suchlin served in the U.S. Peace Corps by teaching English to students in Kazakhstan starting in 2007. He writes about his Central Asia adventure in his book, A Five-Finger Feast. It prepared him to work as a school counselor and an artist in Seattle today. His website is timsuchlinart.com. And that's spelled Suchsland. Tim, I had a Peace Corps friend in Bulgaria, and he claimed that more Peace Corps volunteers fell in love and married a local in Bulgaria than any other place. That's a big part of getting 2 years in a foreign country. You're young, you're single. What's that dynamic of romance on the road and Peace Corps volunteers?
Yeah, in Kazakhstan, it was very similar. There were a number of volunteers who got married, and in our training, the Peace Corps staff would joke, you know, turn to your neighbor in any meeting and one of you guys will get married here to a local.
Because you're the ticket. You're the ticket out.
Yeah.
You're the ticket into the rich world.
It could feel like that. But
I mean, you could be abused. Did they prepare you for that?
Did they prepare us for relationships? Not really. You know, it's They give us some cultural competency and training, but most of the people who I know who got married in the Peace Corps, the people that they married are people who want to be with them. And one of my good friends is actually, they are moving back to Kazakhstan because of opportunities.
I was going to ask you that. Would you say most of those end up moving back to the United States together or staying in that home country?
Probably most end up moving back to the U.S., but there are definitely a number who go back to their host country.
I've run into lots that end up staying in the home country because they really are, well, the person who lived there loves it, and the person who was serving there learns to respect it and enjoy it.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So you've got that dimension of the Peace Corps, and then you wrote that the Peace Corps is the toughest job you'll ever love.
Yeah, that's actually a tagline from an old Peace Corps ad aired, you know, back in the day when Peace Corps was much newer. And it is, it's a tough job. And it's one of those jobs like, my wife, my friends, even my coworkers probably complain about how much I talk about the Peace Corps. And,
yeah.
You know, one reason why I wrote the book is just to get it on paper and be done with it.
Now, you signed up for the Peace Corps. Was it just because you didn't know what else you were going to do for those 2 years, or did you have a personal mission? What did you hope to get out of it?
Yeah, well, I caught the travel bug in college. I studied abroad in Spain and Germany, and I wanted to do something, I think, a little different, and I knew I wanted to travel more. So for that reason, I mean, Peace Corps is a great opportunity
for
Americans.
If you want to live on the road like for 2 years, that's a long time, especially.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a budget trick. You can do that and you won't have to pay for it.
Yeah, of course. But it is, I mean, it's 2 years of commitment and it's work. You know, it's not just travel and have fun. But
does everybody want to go to like Portugal or do you get to choose, you know?
So when I was in the Peace Corps, when you applied and you were accepted, you had some geographical preferences, but you were assigned to where you were going. I don't know what you would, if you said, no, I'm not going to go there. I don't know if they just say, okay, well, bye-bye. Or
they say, well, where would you like to go? they don't need you in Sweden.
And
know?
I think that's different now. It's I think you can actually apply for specific positions and roles.
Do they care if you have the language skills for that?
No, they teach you all the language. I have a friend who speaks fluent Spanish, new French. He thought he was either going to go to French-speaking part of Africa or Latin America for the Peace Corps, and he ended up going to Kazakhstan.
And they knowingly turned their back on those language skills.
Exactly.
To Kazakhstan, where his Spanish was nada.
Yeah, exactly. And they teach you. There's 3 months of language and cultural training when you first arrive to the country.
Do you have to try out for the part, or does anybody get accepted?
You have to apply. There's an application. I think you have to be 18 and over. There's really no cap on how old you could be. So it's not necessarily fresh college grads. You know, it could be mid-career people. It could be retired people.
And you get basically, what, they fly you there, you get the training, they put you up in a house, and you work. Do you get a per diem? Do you get a little pay? How does that work?
When you are in country, you get pay based on the level of what an average person gets paid.
And that money is American taxpayer generated.
Yes, exactly. And then that is put towards your host family. It's put towards any sort of other needs, food. It's put towards any small travel that you might need to do.
So you come out of that 2 year experience with just what you had when you went into it.
For the most part. And then at the end, there's a relocation allowance that they'll give you, but it's, you know, a car payment.
I hope it's still funded, and I hope it's still healthy in our society, because it seems like you can make a case it's a good taxpayer investment.
Oh, yeah. I think it is. In today's world, I think, you know, when I was there, this was 14, 15 years ago, the world seemed like it was opening up. It was so much more open. And today, it's just as things you hear in the news with things going on in Russia or Ukraine, it just seems like it's closing off much more. And that's where I would say, you know, advocate more for more Peace Corps.
If you believe in bridges rather than walls,
yes,
Peace Corps
exactly.
is a good investment. Tim, we're out of time, but I would love just to have your take on a final question. You, back when you were in your 20s or something, you decided to spend 2 years of your life as a volunteer in the Peace Corps. Looking back on that now, was it worth it?
Well, I think every volunteer will get more out of it than any host country national. You know, it's selfishly, yes, I think it's worth it for the volunteer. But I think for the human connections that I made, you know, just the other day, I was emailing with my old counterpart who I worked with, my old host brother, because there's some recent flooding that's occurred in northern Kazakhstan. And so I was just emailing them just because they're my friends, they're my family. You know, it's the people-to-people connection that's important.
That's a global perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the most beautiful souvenir. So from your experience, this would be a good investment for a young person who wants to dedicate a couple years of their life to something out of the ordinary, something exceptional.
Yeah, exactly. The Peace Corps, I mean, it broadens your horizons. And for me, it was this experience that really tested who I was as a person and who I wanted to become as a person.
So who did you want to become?
After the Peace Corps, I became a school counselor, and that experience is directly and because of being in the Peace Corps is why I do what I do today.
Tim Suchlin, thank you for your service to all of us for being in the Peace Corps and for your book, A Five Finger Feast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, the Peace Corps marching song, won't you sing and march along? Doing good in every hemisphere. Oh, the Peace Corps marching song, won't you sing and march along? On our way to find the new frontier.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Quirk. Jerry Frank wrote and performed our theme music. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
I've found that if you equip yourself with good information and expect yourself to travel smart, you can. And that's why the Rick Steves guidebooks are consistently the best-selling series of guides to Europe. Pick up the latest edition at your favorite bookseller or at ricksteves.com.